We had a podcast before we even had a website. Our flagship podcast, the HBR IdeaCast, we launched, I believe, in 2007. And that was our first digital format. It was launched by a guy who's now the editor-in-chief of Sloan Management Review, Paul Michaelman. And he launched it, set it up, got it going, and then needed to hand it off to someone else. And there I was, this very young, new hire who had a lot of time. He was kind of like, here, you can do it. And I was like, what? I can't be the voice of HBR. I'm like 25.
Hey there, you're listening to the show for people who empower other people to do their best work. I'm Jay Akunzo, and this is Org Uncharted. Hello, and welcome to the show that believes in putting the customer first, just like you. We also believe in making decisions from the bottom up and in fighting against top-down leadership because it's broken. This is the official podcast from Tetra, which makes knowledge management and sharing software to help you make better decisions faster as a team. That's right, knowledge sharing matters to make great decisions collectively. Imagine that. On our show website, orguncharted.com, Tetra has collected all kinds of company culture decks for you to review, including Buffer, Google, GitHub, Lululemon, and more. So go behind the scenes with how these companies and others create thriving cultures. Visit orguncharted.com. My dear listener, human beings are so much more than little shapes on an org chart. We have to stop slotting people into our org chart like they're just cogs in a machine. So let's venture beyond the org chart to explore today's theme. Old doesn't have to mean stuck. There's a temptation in the workplace to associate a legacy organization with staleness, maybe stubbornness. They've been around forever, and therefore they're not prone to having lots of new things happen within their walls. They're more prone to having lots of conventional wisdom and lots of processes built up that slow things down. Why do they do things a certain way? Because that's the way we do things around here. So when new technologies change the world, new brands disrupt the industry, or new ideas surface from employees on the front lines, the impulse for these organizations is to say, no, nah, no thanks, no way. Now, here is where you want me to say, but there are companies proving that red tape won't develop. Or maybe you want me to say that there are huge organizations out there that can be as fast as a startup. Or maybe you want me to cite examples. Examples like GE with their amazing new podcasts, or the younger but still not that young Microsoft and all they're doing to evolve. But the fact is, a well-known legacy brand has high stakes, period. They have bureaucracy, period. They have lots and lots of stakeholders and decision makers to consider, period. And they are populated by leaders and practitioners who succeeded doing things an older way because they all built their careers during a different period. That is the reality. And that brings us back to today's theme. Old doesn't have to mean stuck, does it?
A lot of media companies, especially in the digital age, do try to affect kind of a snarky tone, and that is not us at all. So sometimes that leaves us, I think, feeling a little bit like the boring grown-up in the room, but that is sort of what people need sometimes.
That's Sarah Green Carmichael, and she is the executive editor of Harvard Business Review. As executive editor, Sarah oversees the direction and the finalized versions of lots of their widely read articles that make it to their digital publication. She also hosts two of their podcasts, the HBR IdeaCast, which has been going on forever, it's a great show, and the newer Women at Work. From their tone of voice to the authoritative perch that they sit on, HBR is totally the grown-up in the room. I mean, come on, they've been around since 1922. So given their brand's allure and their sage wisdom, not to mention their age, you would never expect them to be leading the way in digital media. But today, they're totally crushing it. I mean, they were early adopters of Facebook Live, pioneers in the podcasting space. They combined the best of both creative and analytical thinking and tools to overhaul their website and match the demands and behavior of the digital and mobile consumption of their readers today. They are evolving. So how do you turn a 96-year-old institution into a modern digital powerhouse? That's what I wanted to explore with Sarah. The tone of voice to me and the legacy of the publication, just the both the size, the history, and the tone. From the cheap seats where I sit, I'm looking at what you're doing, which is all of these digital experiments and digital projects. And I'm thinking, how in the world did Sarah push a publication, again, of that size, tone, and number of years running now, into the digital age? So has that been like a conscious effort in your career? And, you know, how hard has it been? What's been your, like, I don't know, your marching orders or your mission when it comes to like moving HBR into the digital age? How have you come at that problem?
I think we are, in some ways, the ideal publication to figure some of this stuff out, because we're publishing about it all the time. So if we can't do it based on the advice we're publishing, then that's a problem. The flip side of that is that we have some of the best, in my opinion, people who think about digital strategy and business transformation and change leadership writing for us. And they all are really happy to give us free advice. So I think that's really helped. But I think in terms of our digital journey, I mean, we have a pretty impassioned, farsighted CEO who understands kind of where the business is going. We have a great editor-in-chief in place. Two people that I worked with for most of my time at HBR, Catherine Bell and Eric Helwig, who really put then that sort of web team, as we call it, together and figured out how we were going to integrate with the print team and the books team, and how we were going to not just sort of be our own team like a little island, but how are we going to really bridge these different, I'm not going to say silos, I won't do it, but how are we going to bridge these different departments in a way that can help the whole organization become more digitally aware and prepared for the future?
When you're thinking about, let's say all of the people that you just mentioned or you're thinking about left HBR, you know, everybody's high fives and hugs leaving, and then you have a reunion someday and you're looking back at like this digital transformation that HBR has undergone, what's the project you're all pointing to and being like, oh, remember when we did that thing? That was such a great and seminal moment for our digital evolution.
So I think the current iteration of the website is a big deal, because for us, that was like a great leap forward into like responsive design, and so many involved so much of like work on the back end. The front end also looked totally different, but that was like the least of it. If you had told me 10 years ago when I started that our static web page, we had to have like a, at the very beginning, we had a separate URL. We were very much following like a have a separate innovative team that incubates things and then maybe brings them over to the mothership kind of business model approach. If you had told me then that we would have this award-winning website that we have today, I would have just been like, oh, well, you know, that takes a load off my mind, because it wasn't always clear that's where we were going to end up. So I think that the current iteration of the website is something that took a lot of work and really set us up for the future, because now we're in a position where we can just kind of change the look and feel of it, and we don't have to worry as much about re-engineering the whole back end, which I feel like is the most boring answer, but someone out there listening will be like, yes, the back end of the website, I care about that.
Right. If you're doing something online and you don't have the infrastructure to move at the speed of tech, you're going to fall flat on your face.
Yeah, totally. And it was one of those things where it's like, you know, it's like renovating a house. No one wants to replace the boiler. Like, that's not fun. But if you don't have that, then you don't really have much of a house. So yeah, that was maybe the project that we all look back on.
You've also done a lot with podcasting. I think it's another example of how your work specifically has helped evolve HBR in a really positive way. Talk about how you first got your hands on the podcast, and then also the second one that you launched. How did you justify launching a second show?
Yep. So for us, the podcast has been an incredibly important and influential digital format. So we had a podcast before we even had a website. Our flagship podcast, the HBR IdeaCast, we launched, I believe, in 2007, and that was our first digital format. So that chugged along for a good long time and was successful and had a lot of great organic growth. And we kind of had this moment after the kind of second launch of podcasts, after Serial, when the whole sector started really going again and growing again, we decided that we should launch another podcast. And we had a lot of ideas about what that might be, and we launched two new shows. One of them is Women at Work, which I co-host with Nicole Torres and Amy Bernstein. The second podcast is Dear HBR. And so we intentionally took two very different approaches with those shows because we wanted to kind of experiment and learn and see what worked and what we could do better. And both of them so far are doing pretty well. So we're excited about that.
What is the process like internally, especially when you have a brand that, you know, things that you launch, I think it's easier when you're a startup and nobody pays attention to you, but people pay attention to HBR and there's a certain level of expectation that I'm sure you have for your work and also people have for your work. So what's the process of developing a new show behind the scenes? Because it does, I know the format was familiar to you, but I'm sure a lot of the execution and the talent and things like that and who you're going to talk to and the production value, there's a lot of variables that are unknowns. So how do you come at doing something new for a brand that is known and has high expectations?
That is a very perceptive question because we do feel that we are not in a business where we can really do something that's like a minimum viable product legitimately. So we try to be kind of lean in our experimentation, but realistically speaking, when you have a brand that's built on getting it right and being excellent the first time, it's really hard to do that. So what we tried to do was we did some prototypes of the shows that we only listened to internally. We told ourselves, like, this is probably not going to be good enough to air, but we're going to give everything that we can to making these prototypes good enough to air. And we did that a couple times until we really felt like we had found the right kind of formula and the right approach. So that was one thing, was just making content that we knew would most likely never see the light of day, which is hard to spend your time on that when, you know, you don't have a lot of time. We're not making a lot of things that we're killing normally.
We're in uncharted territory now, so let's dive even deeper into this idea that just because a company is older doesn't mean it can't evolve. In doing so, we're going to find a few treasures that we can take back with us to our work, whether we work at a large legacy organization or a newer startup. So, Sarah, you're someone who keeps pushing the publication forward, and I think there's always an inherent friction that humans have to change, whether or not a company or a team actually wants to change. And I think it's clear that you have a very collaborative, positive environment that you work in, but that doesn't make change easier or make evolution simpler, right? So what have been the most challenging moments that you've encountered along the way?
I think that, so after the 2008 recession, when we basically used that as a chance to restructure our business. And we went from three very distinct separate businesses, so the book division, the print magazine division, and the digital team, to being one editorial team and to saying to people, you know, you're now going to work across platforms. You're not just a magazine editor. You also have to edit stuff for the web. You're not just a book editor. You're also doing stuff for the web. And, you know, you're not just a web editor. You also have to contribute to these print platforms. And that was a time of enormous change internally. And that meant a lot of editors had to learn a lot of new skills. And I think there was a lot of enthusiasm and interest, but it's also hard. I mean, it's like you're doing this one thing that's taking up all of your time. And then your boss comes to you and says, oh, we now need you to keep doing all of that and add this other thing. That's hard.
How did you solve that problem?
We had a lot of one-on-one conversations with people, and we tried to institute some processes that were kind of flexible and that would kind of keep us going, but give us room to experiment and room to do different things. An example of that would be, you know, when we started doing digital articles, we had a very loosey-goosey process for that. For the magazine, it was, you know, editors really had to come and they had to pitch a central editor to say, like, is this an article that you want? Okay, I'll go develop it. And with the web, we tried to say, you know, if you're excited about an idea, there's a 95% chance that we will be too. And I think, especially in the beginning, giving people that sense of ownership over, like, oh, I can do this. I have the authority to greenlight something really helped, because it was like this little piece of property that they could really own and play with.
So what do you say is next for HBR's digital evolution? Like, where can you improve? I think, you know, if I'm being honest, everything you've said so far makes it sound like you guys have passed with flying colors. And so I imagine there's lots of challenges, if that was the case, that you're like looking at and saying, okay, we've had success so far, let's keep pushing. Where else are you trying to push towards? Is it, you know, are these channel specific, technology specific type things, or are they more like areas for improvement that sit horizontal to all your projects?
I mean, there's definitely channel specific things we can improve. There's definitely technological things we can improve. Anyone who's ever tried to use our site search knows that it's not good. So that is one of the major initiatives we're looking at this year to be like, okay, it's 2018. Like, there's no excuse for having site search that is this hard to figure out how to use. So there are some ways in which, you know, we do really need to step up. I tend to think, based on where I sit, mostly about the ideas and the kind of competition for ideas. When we started out, you know, there weren't very many places covering new academic research. Well, there has been this whole explosion in covering social science and covering psychological science. The New York Times has the Upshot. Quartz covers a lot of research. So we really feel now like we are in a race to get to new research, the most interesting research, as quickly as we can, but also as responsibly as we can. We don't ever want to be one of those publications that's like, on Tuesday, coffee is bad for you, but on Wednesday, coffee is good for you.
What would you say to people that are facing similar challenges to you? So I'd point to two that you've articulated so far. So one is working for an organization where there's high expectations that everything you deliver will be great right out of the box. However, you have to test to learn, right? So let's start there. What would you say to an organization or an employee or a leader at that organization that really does want to move faster, evolve, test and learn, you know, operate at the speed of the world today, but they are either held back by internal political forces or just the expectations that are really high in terms of the audience that they face?
I think what's worked for us is doing really small experiments. So trying to figure out some way, if you can't test the whole thing, is there a way that you can test some piece of the thing? If you want to try a new format, for example, is there a way that you can do like a mini experiment? So can you do a short Instagram video where maybe the stakes are relatively low and then use that to inform maybe what you do with your higher end video program? So we were able to use Facebook Live, for example, as a way to do a lot of new video experimentation. And since Facebook Live was brand new, and since it was Facebook, it was kind of like people's expectations actually were pretty low, even for established media companies. I feel like it's sort of finding those spots when you know the audience will forgive you and finding the right people who are enthusiastic about your brand and will give you a lot of rope and who want to see you succeed, but who will also tell you when you are doing something that is not what they want. Finding sort of the right people to give you that feedback is really helpful. And I don't think that sort of focus groups work. So I'm not suggesting that. I'm talking about sort of real experiments with the right kind of customers live in the field, I think can be really helpful.
I love the live in the field idea. There are some people that are probably like, I can't even get something out the door. But I would point to a documentary film by the tech company Envision called Design Disruptors. Sarah, is this something that you're familiar with? Or
I am not.
So Design Disruptors is an hour long, fully produced documentary, which is gorgeous, from this software company that helps create tools to help product designers. And the reason I bring this up is the way it got started wasn't to create a film. Like, the people behind the film didn't get sign off or budget. They were creating these like slightly more innovative or more refreshing case studies. And then they were like, well, it's not really going to cut it. Look how great these are. Wouldn't this be better as a whole film? So they actually didn't share the test externally. They were like sharing it with each other and their executives and being like, this was our proposed solution. Like, in the back of their minds, they wanted to make this big film. But when they got started, when they got permission or budget, all they could do was create case studies. So into those little case studies went a few questions and some production polish that resemble the documentary. And they convinced the stakeholders internally that we actually need to blow this out, which I thought was just a genius way to come at this idea of testing something small.
Yes, I think that sounds helpful. I think in a way, so one of the challenges that we have had is figuring out what quality is in different contexts. Because I think one of the things that was challenging for us, especially in the beginning, is that like a 1,000 word article to some editors might not seem like it's very high quality because it's, you know, only a quarter of the size of a 4,000 word article. And so I think we had to have a lot of conversations about like how to do really good short form content for the web and how a sort of different way of measuring quality wasn't a different standard of quality. But I think what your story sort of conveys to me is that like a similar kind of conversation has to happen in a lot of businesses where you're like, okay, we want to make this different kind of product. It's not the thing that we're known for making. We haven't tried it before. And the first reaction is often kind of like, whoa, what is that? That's not our brand. But you have to kind of figure out like, well, is there a way that we can do this new thing that does feel like us, even though it is so different than what we've done before?
I love that. So that's the first thing that I want to talk to you about, which is this problem that you identified and a thing that you were good at in terms of pushing a new project with high stakes. The second thing I think you seem to be really adept at doing is using new tools. So it's not just the size or newness of the project, it's the digital side of a legacy business. So how were you able to convince people at HBR, or what would you say to others who are struggling to do something like you did, to actually convince people who are thinking about legacy channels or modes of operating to evolve?
I mean, it's hard to do if you are not at the top, right? Because I think if you are at the top, you can kind of say, listen, we are going to start an Instagram feed, and there might be people in this building who are like, why is our shipping container company starting an Instagram feed? But we are going to hire someone who is going to do it and, you know, manage our other social media, and they are going to do it differently than we've done before. And it's not going to be stodgy and boring. It's not going to be just responding to customer service. Like, we're going to try to be creative. If you are an executive at a level in an organization where you can sort of plant that flag and create that room for someone to come in and be creative, like, that is much easier than being someone in the middle or kind of towards the bottom who sees a need and is trying to convince some older, more powerful, skeptical people to go along and give you that breathing room and that chance. But I still think that you can do it, even if you are sort of not the most powerful person in the room. You kind of have to take a, well, let's just try it and see what happens approach, right? Like, let's just try a small experiment. It's an experiment. It's hard to say no to something that's just an experiment. And if it doesn't work, I mean, the thing you also really have to be willing to do is you have to be really willing to admit when your idea hasn't worked, and you have to be willing to pull the plug on it. Otherwise, you know, it's not an experiment, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'd put a pin in a couple things there. One is lower the stakes in the minds of others, right? Like, yes, you might want to transform your business or operate a certain way that hasn't been done before, but seems more modern. But if you get friction, if you get pushback, just lower the stakes. It's not radical change. It's a tiny step or a tiny experiment. And then the other point, which really resonates deeply with me, which is like, be willing to kill your darlings. You have to be willing to just kind of step back once in a while and look at something objectively in terms of how it's performing and be willing to kill it.
Yeah. And I think it's one of those things, I wish I could remember who gave this advice, but I thought it was so helpful. They were like, if someone ever says to you, like, this isn't working, you should believe them. If they try to tell you why it's not working, maybe you shouldn't believe them, like, on why. But like, to have a sort of listener or reader or customer say, like, this just isn't working for me, like, that's feedback you need to be able to take.
Absolutely. And I know we keep talking about content, but you can substitute the word creativity for quality. But I think creativity with the capital C makes sense. So it's a creative approach, not necessarily creative, so to speak. But let's talk about our worlds and content, you and me, Sarah. Good creative or good content should measure well. And I have a lot of people who come to me and say, how do I create, I want to create a podcast like you have, Jay, or write something more creative or whatever, but my boss needs to measure everything I do. And it's like, that's fine. Great creative should measure well. Data and ideas, they work together to give you an insight. Like, that this should be harmonious, not full of conflict. And yet, unfortunately, it becomes a tension.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I think one of the big challenges that media companies have had, and in some ways media companies are just the leading edge of a transformation that's happening in lots of businesses, but is sort of coming to the realization with the rise of the internet that a lot of the content they were really proud of doing wasn't what people were willing to pay for. And this whole disruption we have been seeing is companies from HBR to the Washington Post to BuzzFeed coming up with ways to figure out how to make a business model around doing stuff that their people feel like really matters, you know, the stories that really matter. And the old newspaper business model, people could think, oh, you know, our readers are paying for this hard news, when actually the readers were just paying for the classifieds and the sports pages. And the internet kind of ripped the cover off all of that and exposed that actually, no, like readers were paying for this, the stuff that a lot of the journalists thought was kind of fluff and didn't really matter. And I think that was a really hard pill for a lot of people in the industry to swallow. And I'm glad that we now seem to be on the other side of that. And we're instead thinking about like, okay, how do we make a go of this? Because this is the new world that we're in.
Big thank you to our guest today, Sarah Green Carmichael, who shared all that wisdom. Be sure to give her a shout on Twitter at SK Green. You can follow Tetra on Twitter at Team Tetra, or head over to the show website for culture decks from some of the world's top brands at orguncharted.com. All of these links are in the show notes. This show is a production of Unthinkable Media, which makes refreshingly entertaining shows about work. It's hosted by me, Jay Akunzo, and produced by Annie Sinzabah. This was the second to last episode of season one, and we're back in another couple of weeks with a very special season finale. I'll talk to you then on that final season one episode of Org Uncharted. See ya.